We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus, we'll be considering a question that is very old, a question people have been asking for a long time through human history, that question being, are we alone in the universe? Probably for a lot of human history, it was a question that was asked by theologians and philosophers, but it is also a question that for about a half century now has been taken very seriously by scientists, beginning at that point 50 years ago this past spring, where for the first time a radio telescope was turned at the sky with the intent of looking for a possible message coming to us from some alien civilization somewhere else. It's now an effort that is continuing and an effort that a lot of people support. Also, though, there are those scientists who say, well, that is certainly fine, and it's an interesting thing to do, but that perhaps there are other ways in which we could explore this particular question. And we'll be talking in this hour of the show with the author of a book that explores this very territory. Our guest is Paul Davies, and his book is titled The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence. And he says, indeed, it is something that is worth doing, and in as many different ways as it possibly can be done. So we'll be talking about that with him in this hour of the show. Our guest is a theoretical physicist. He is also a cosmologist, an astrobiologist, and an author. He's director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, and is also co-director of the Cosmology Initiative, and both of those are based at Arizona State University. He's also taught in the UK and also in Australia at University of Adelaide. He's interested in a lot of different things, including the origins of life in the universe and also the search for life in the universe. He's written a number of books for both astronomers and also for the general audience, and among his bestsellers are the books The Mind of God, About Time, How to Build the Time Machine, The Fifth Miracle, and The Goldilocks Enigma, and then also the most recent, the book The Eerie Silence, which I'm sure you can find in the bookstore now. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Questions are welcome, as long as people can stay on the topic and try to keep them brief. They're certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can send emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Davies, hello.
Good morning, and thank you for that very full and flattering introduction.
Well, I would like to give people an idea of who you are and what you're interested in and the scope of your work. I try not to go on too long. We could have gone on longer. I certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. As far as the question of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe goes, just to establish where you are with it. I think you describe yourself as being someone who is a skeptic, but also somebody who believes that the search, that asking the question and looking for an answer is something that's well worthwhile.
That's exactly right. I think all scientists should be open-minded, but they should also be skeptical. Otherwise, we fall for any random claim. And in this subject, which is sort of out on the fringes of science, though respectable enough, we have to be very, very careful in evaluating evidence. And I, along with most of my colleagues, believe that at this time we have no positive evidence for any life beyond Earth, let alone intelligent life. That doesn't mean it's not out there, but we just don't have the evidence yet. And so I fully support this search, which, as you mentioned, has been going for 50 years now in its current phase of looking for radio messages. But I also think we shouldn't leave it to just a small heroic band of radio astronomers to do all the heavy lifting. We need to widen the search to encompass the entire scientific community. Mm-hmm. And what I've tried to do in my book is lay out an agenda for what else we might look for to address this fundamental question, are we alone in the universe?
I do think that it's striking to note that say, 50 years ago when with the man that you talk about here, Frank Drake, first started this effort that then grew into the thing that today we call SETI, the Search for Intelligent Life in the Universe, that a lot of people thought this question wasn't serious and that no serious scientist would spend his or her time with it. And that's right. Something that certainly has changed.
Yes, I'm old enough to remember the early days of SETI. I was interested in it. I was a student in London in the 60s. And one might as well have professed an interest in fairies. It was regarded as a quixotic quest at best and crackpot at worst. I think the mood was very much summed up by the famous biologist Jacques Monod, who got the Nobel Prize for his work on the genetic code, who said that man at last knows he is alone in the universe, out of which he has emerged only by chance. And that was the feeling in those days, that life was some bizarre fluke, a freak event that had just happened on one planet, and we're it, and that the chances of it happening twice, even within the vastness of the observable universe, was infinitesimal, and that was the party line. But the pendulum has now swung, and I would say, if anything, it's swung a bit too far the other way. There's now a sort of credulity in the scientific community and a feeling that the universe is teeming with life, even though we have no evidence for that, that it's there are going to be billions and billions of planets with life and some with intelligent life. And so that's become the default option. But curiously, the science hasn't changed. In those 50 years, very little is known now that changes the odds. We're still just as much in the dark about most of the factors that we would need to know in order to be able to work out what are the odds of there being intelligent life out there. So it's a very curious shift of fashion.
Well, there are people who will make the arguments on both sides. There are scientists who will look at everything that had to happen, what had to be in place for life to arise on Earth, and they make the argument that it's so difficult that it's not unreasonable to posit that this is the only place there's life. On the other side, it seems to me that the argument usually is framed in terms of the size and the age of the universe, and that the argument would be made, well, we know that there are elsewhere, there are planets that are orbiting stars, many other Earth-like planets, and the argument seems to be, well, when you consider all of those, do you really, what are the odds really in all these places where there could be life, that the only life in the entire universe is on the Earth? It's sort of a statistical argument more than anything else. Is there more to support that argument than that, just the sheer size of the universe?
You're absolutely right that this is an argument which is very commonly used, most commonly by Stephen Hawking in some provocative remarks a few weeks ago. It's a completely bogus argument, and I think we should try to nail this right at the outset. Yes, of course, the universe is vast. There's plenty of real estate. Probably, my estimate would be, one followed by 23 zeros of Earth-like planets within the volume of the universe that we can, in principle, access, so the observable universe, I call it. That's a big number, one followed by 23 zeros. But it's a tiny, tiny number compared to the odds of shuffling molecules into the right arrangement to get life in the first place. Now, we could have a go at estimating the odds of how life came into existence if we knew what happened. But we have plenty of theories and conjectures about life's origin, but we don't have an agreed mechanism. This is in contrast to the evolution of life. Once life gets going, we understand the mechanism that can turn, say, a bacterium into an intelligent being like a human being over billions of years. Darwin's theory of evolution. We understand the mechanism of that. It's very simple. What we don't understand is the mechanism that turned non-life into life. And we could imagine that this was a very, very improbable freak accident of just the right molecules coming together in the right way at the right time, in which case the odds against that would dwarf that number of one followed by 23 zeros. Mm-hmm. So even though that's big by human standards, it would be tiny by the standards of shuffling molecules randomly into the right combination. But it's equally possible that life is, so to speak, written into the laws of the universe in a more fundamental way, that it emerges through a sequence of self-organizing and self-complexifying processes that would fast-track matter to life against all those odds, the raw odds. But seeing as we don't know which of these two or where in between was the correct explanation, we can't possibly put a number to it. And so I'm not saying that the universe isn't teeming with life. I'm saying we can't make that statement just because the universe is big.
Hmm. Could the, in our own solar system, the bodies in our own solar system exchange material, have exchanged material quite a bit?
Yes.
So would it be reasonable maybe to make an argument that says, well, maybe life, because of the difficulty of life, so we could say, well, maybe it did actually only start in one place, but could it possibly have, over the time the universe has been around, which has been a long time, could it possibly have moved around enough so that there could have been one point of origin and it spread out from there?
It's a very ancient idea. It's called panspermia. It goes back actually thousands of years, that life starts somewhere we know not where and spreads in the manner you have described. And there's certainly been plenty of time for microorganisms to go from one planet to another. And this was an idea popular right up until about 100 years ago, when it was discovered that outer space is a lethal environment because of the radiation, cosmic rays and ultraviolet from the sun and stars. Mm. It's a very uncongenial place for life to be. Now, there is a caveat here, because cocooned inside a rock, microorganisms could survive those conditions in outer space for a long period of time. And this opens up the way to a sort of cross-fertilization or cross-contamination of neighboring planets. And the two that I've thought most about are Mars and Earth. I think it's inevitable if you get life on Mars, it will come to Earth, and vice versa. So within the solar system, a bit of mixing and matching of life, I think, is pretty much assured over the billions of years of the solar system's history. But when you start talking about a rock being blasted off Earth, traveling across the galaxy and hitting another Earth-like planet in another star system, maybe hundreds or thousands of light years away, the odds dramatically go down. And when you work it out, it seems that this is not a mechanism that is ever going to cause life to spread very far. So, yes, within the solar system, but I think not as an explanation for life spreading around the universe. Mm.
Our guest, Paul Davies, he's a physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist at Arizona State University, author of a number of books. His most recent is The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk at illinois.edu. I want to return just a little bit to SETI, and maybe you could, I mentioned Frank Drake, this man who in 1960, he was a young astronomer, he turned the telescope to a particular point with the idea of listening. What was it that that possessed him to do this?
Well, there was a bit of a prehistory to Frank's endeavor. And I have to say, Frank is a hero of mine. He's still in the game. He's now in his late 70s, and he's still an active astronomer, and he's still upbeat about SETI in spite of 50 years of disappointment. And that's got to say something about the man's optimism. So I've dedicated my book to him. But he began this search hot on the heels of a famous paper that appeared in the journal Nature in 1959 by Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison at MIT. And they had been thinking about the power of radio telescopes. Radio astronomy we take for granted these days, but it was a newfangled thing in the 50s. It really grew out of the radar work during the Second World War. And these astronomers got their hands on cheap equipment, and they realized that they had, with these big dishes, instruments that could not only communicate across the planet, one side of the Earth to the other, but communicate across interstellar distances. And it occurred to a few people that if we wanted to send messages to the stars or to alien beings out there, and more to the point, if they wanted to send messages to us, these instruments could do it. We actually, with our radio telescopes, could pick up signals beamed by similar instruments many, many light years away. And so the comment in the Nature paper, I think, was really in many ways an emblem for this whole enterprise, that although the chances of success of SETI are very small, if nobody tries, the chances are zero. And so Frank took up that challenge, and he had a wish list of nearby stars that he began looking at, and that list has grown and grown, of course, over the decades, and this is now a major international enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And so you, just to be clear, you, it's an enterprise that you would support, and you would say, in addition to your what you talk about in the book is other ways to pursue this question, but you would also say, or would you say that it that SETI is something that we should continue to do?
Well, I think we should certainly continue to do it in the sense that, first of all, they're funded to do it, and secondly, they've got better and better at it over the years and will continue to get better, and so you should always do the things you do well. But I also have a fundamental problem with it, and this problem is easily stated. We have to ask, why would ET be beaming messages at us at this particular time? And if you ask Frank, for example, how close do you think the nearest civilization is likely to be? Because he doesn't know any more than anybody else, but he likes to say about 1,000 light years. Well, if you live 1,000 light years from Earth, you don't see Earth as it is today. You see it as it was 1,000 years ago. And there were no radio telescopes here 1,000 years ago. Now, a very advanced community 1,000 light years away may have the instruments to detect that there is intelligent life on Earth. In principle, they could see the pyramids, for example, or the Great Wall of China. And they may figure that any millennium soon, there would be radio telescopes here. But it would make no sense for them to start beaming messages at us until they knew we were definitely on the air. And they could tell that as soon as they picked up our first radio messages leaking out into space. But that won't be for about another 900 years. And so it seems very unlikely that a very distant civilization like that would just be beaming continuously over thousands and thousands of years at a planet on which they were pretty sure there was intelligent life, but without any expectation that there was anyone on the air to pick up their messages. Mm-hmm. They would surely wait. So I think the whole SETI philosophy is a great one, but it's maybe a thousand years too soon. But that, meanwhile, you see, we don't have to give up. The point is that we would settle for an answer to the big question, are we alone in the universe? We don't actually have to pick up a message from ET to answer that question. We simply have to find incontrovertible evidence of some alien technology. It could be radio traffic, but it could be many other things as well. And I think if we found that there was a star, say 1,000 light years away from Earth, where there was something sufficiently peculiar about it that we could say there's no natural explanation, that must be the product of alien technology, that would make the point. We'd love to have a message, of course, but I think we'd still be very excited to know that there was alien technology out there.
We have several callers, obviously. That topic has piqued people's interest. The lines are full, so we'll start talking with folks. And again, people can help us to move along and get in as many callers as we can by trying to be brief. We'll start in with a caller in Indiana. They're the first in line. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. When I first heard the sort of advertisement about this show in the last few days, I thought that where it was going was that be other than electromagnetic radiation as a way to find out if there's alien civilizations. And I started thinking about that doesn't make much sense. So my question is, if it makes any sense at all in this relationship, is what constraints on civilization or life or whatever you want to call it are going to be there right from the start because of physics itself?
Right. It's an excellent question. Thank you for asking that. And what I do in the book is to try and set out this delicate dividing line between science and science fiction and pseudoscience and so on. A lot of people will say, for example, that the fundamental law of physics that nothing can travel faster than light places an obvious limitation. I've just been using that reasoning in saying that a civilization 1,000 light years away couldn't know we exist because it takes light at least 1,000 years to travel that distance, and anything else would take at least 1,000 years. And some people say, well, how do you know that that's right? Maybe another 100 years we'll discover that this law of physics is in fact wrong and it is possible to go faster than light. Well, the attitude that I take in the SETI program is that if we throw our science out the window and just sort of have an anything-goes attitude, well, then it becomes a rather valueless exercise. And so I think we have to stick with the very best understanding of fundamental physics that we've got, including the no faster than light rule, and then work on the basis of that. What might we expect to see given those constraints? And if we really believe that these are universal laws of physics, they will apply everywhere in the universe, then the aliens are stuck with the same laws as we are. And this raises the whole delicate difference between what might be technically impossible and what might be physically impossible. Traveling faster than light, we think, is physically impossible. There may be some things which are in principle possible, but actually exceedingly difficult or exceedingly expensive to do. And that includes, for example, journeying between the stars. In principle, it's possible to fly very, very close to the speed of light and travel immense distances. But the huge amounts of energy that are needed might make that forever an impractical proposition. And so we have to distinguish between what are fundamental laws and limitations and what might just be limitations of resources and money and motivation and so on. So, but we, you know, this is in the dark. I mean, it's entirely a speculative exercise. We're having to second guess alien motives without even understanding the alien mind, and it's a very, very difficult thing to do.
So just that you put your finger on the thing that makes the business of interstellar communication and even if you make the leap to interstellar travel, a big problem are the distances involved.
Right.
So for that reason, and as far as we know, the laws of physics apply everywhere.
Right.
And so that would make it probably just as very difficult for us to think about going there. It should make it equally difficult to think about them if there is any them coming here.
That's right. So I do consider, because I'm trying to be as open-minded as possible, the idea that some alien civilizations may have advanced to the point where they want to spread beyond their home planet out into the galaxy, and then what pattern of migration might we expect? And people have done models of this, and it's not just a matter of spreading out in a wave. If you can have a sort of marble pattern, you can have all sorts of different things depending on the assumptions that you put in. And then ask the question, well, supposing a civilization had arisen, I don't know, 1 billion years ago, for example, we have to think in terms of billions of years in this game, not just thousands, but billions of years, then is there a possibility that this civilization could have passed through the solar system at some stage, maybe 100 million years ago? And would we know? Might there be alien artifacts that we could discover? Or if not artifacts, at least signs of alien technology or tinkering in our own astronomical backyard. So one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is say, well, we shouldn't just look right across the other side of the galaxy for signs of alien intelligence, but in our own local neighborhood, that there could be ways in which there could be signs from very, very long ago. And anything that doesn't last a long time probably is of no interest. But there are some things we could look for even after 100 million years.
Other callers. Let's go to Champaign. There are a couple of people. We'll go first to line one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question and a concern. My question is, we're trying to listen, right, to frequencies of electromagnetic radiation. Is that what we're listening
That's
for?
That's right.
Could it be possible that there are frequencies or types of electromagnetic radiation that we don't know about even, and they're beaming in that sort of frequency that we're not even able to listen for?
Well, this is a sensible question. As far as electromagnetic radiation is concerned, we know all of the spectrum, and so we've got it all covered. The point about radio and light as well is that they penetrate the atmosphere. So that's the reason people use radio searches and they use optical searches as well. It may be that ET is beaming laser messages at us. So these are part of the program. The other regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, we couldn't do that from the Earth's surface. We could, in principle, do it from space-based instruments. So
it's possible that our technology could be so primitive that they're not even using that kind of technology to beam messages
right.
out. They could be using a technology that uses electromagnetic radiation in a totally different spectrum than what we're listening for.
Right. Now, there are some limitations of the galaxy itself. Not all wavelengths or frequencies travel well across the galaxy. So, again, radio and light are good ones to use.
Okay.
But there are regions in the microwave part of the spectrum which don't come down to the ground too well. You need to go to mountaintops and so on, which would be perfectly respectable.
So really, we need a spacecraft doing this, not here below the atmosphere.
Right, very expensive, I'm afraid, because you need a big dish.
My concern is, what if a race that likes to conquer, or a species that likes to conquer and subjugate and exploit and profit from other species through military means, what if we run into those people? Maybe it's not wise to do this.
Well, we're only listening, and there's no particular reason why...
you mean we're not beaming a bunch of stuff out? Just
no, we're not, except very occasionally for a gimmick. No. But my point is that even that is pretty harmless for the simple reason that why would the aliens be interested in our planet is what I always ask. Now, why do you think that...
It's always resources.
Right. Well, these resources have been here for 4.5 billion years, and the aliens could have come at any stage to take them. They don't need us to tell them about the resources. They're capable of picking up our messages. They're certainly capable of knowing about the resources.
I
think the messaging is irrelevant. If they want to colonize our planet, they could do it at any time. But more to the point, and this often goes by the name of the Fermi paradox, because it goes back to Enrico Fermi's comment 60 years ago, where are they? Where is everybody? The point is, Earth has been here 4.5 billion years. The galaxy is 13 billion years old. There were stars and planets around long before Earth even existed. If there were aggressive expansionary aliens out there, they could have come at any time during Earth's history. The chances of them showing up just as we get interested in the subject are infinitesimal. Mm. I think if Earth was going to be taken over, it would have happened a long time ago.
That does, though. I know that there are various people, and then maybe even some scientists who float that sort of argument that says, in fact, here on Earth, what we really ought to be doing is keeping our heads down and not doing something to attract attention to ourselves for that very reason.
Yes, I think it's a silly argument. I really do, for the simple reason that there's no point in aliens coming here for us, for we human beings. And as I said earlier, that they would know about the planet and its resources. I can imagine they might think, well, that's a nice planet, and it's got metals we want, or it's got a biosphere we could exploit or something. I could believe all that. But what I couldn't believe is that they're going to say, that's a good slave labor force or something, mm-hmm. because we're talking about beings who, by definition, if they could get here, would be probably millions of years in advance of us technologically. And there's no conceivable way that we human beings could be of any use to them. They could easily engineer their own biological slaves if they wanted to do so. Mm. So I've never felt that attracting attention to ourselves, so to speak, carries the slightest danger. I do think there is another aspect to this story that a colleague of mine, David Brin, draws attention to this often, which is not that we're doing something dangerous or precipitate in sending messages. It's just that when we send messages, somehow the people doing this are setting themselves up as spokespersons of mankind, and nobody really has the right to do that. I think it's a harmless gimmick, but if we take this more seriously, then if we are going to send messages to some putative alien somewhere out there, then maybe we need to think a little bit about what we're going to say and who speaks for mankind. And I think that is a more serious issue, that we should perhaps, not be too gung-ho about beaming messages into space. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I think it's an interesting conversation how it is we imagine aliens and why it is that sometimes we either think that they're going to be nice or we think that they're going to not be nice, and maybe more often we think they're not going to be nice. I think maybe that tells you something more about actually what we think about human nature than what we think about potential alien nature.
Well, it tells us a lot about Hollywood. So that's right. But you see, in this game, there's this one of the things that is a bugbear right from the start is the anthropocentrism that pervades it, even in the SETI community. People tend to think, well, what would we do, and try to extrapolate ahead, you know, of thousands of years or millions of years or something, and almost certainly you're going to be led astray. And I can just see that even within the 50 years that SETI has been going, there's been a shift of priorities. So, for example, in the early days, people worried a lot about which frequency would ET beam in on, and they tried to sort of second guess, you know, what they would do. And then along came the technology for us to monitor all the frequencies at once, and so that problem went away. And then people said, oh, surely the aliens wouldn't mess around with this old-fashioned radio. They'd have this wonderful new gadget called the laser. And so then optical SETI began. And then people thought, well, how long are these civilizations out there going to last? Maybe if they have radio telescopes, they'll have nuclear weapons and they'll blow themselves up within a few years, because that's what we're going to do, because this was in the Cold War when all this stuff started. And then the Cold War finished and people began to have more concerns about the environment and limited resources. And so now you'll hear people say, well, you know, the aliens wouldn't be beaming messages with us for very long because they would be, they'd have good green credentials, they wouldn't squander energy and so on. So you see how the whole SETI program just has reflected human politics, even over a few decades. But we can't guess what the motives and priorities, and certainly not the politics and economics of an alien civilization might be after millions and millions of years. And we must be mindful of the fact they may not even be flesh and blood beings. I make a big point in the book of saying that the biological phase of intelligence may just be a transitory phase in the evolution of intelligence in the universe, and that we can see even on Earth we're about to hand over the mantle. Certainly the intellectual heavy lifting is being done more and more by machines now, in the sense of, machines is the wrong word, but computing systems, the internet, distributed information processing systems. Surely this is going to be even more true on an alien planet. So we might not be dealing with flesh and blood beings at all.
Well, I have some calls. I promise to get right to these people. But I think that seems to me to be an important point. That is, if the alien life form is so different, we almost can't quite imagine what it would be like because it's so different. Might that mean that communication would be, I hesitate to say, impossible, but perhaps it wouldn't be possible?
It would be a challenge, and people will often remark that there's enough misunderstandings between different ethnic groups on our own planet. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you were dealing with a totally different species. It would be very, very difficult. So I think by common consent, the one thing that would be universal between even alien species is mathematics, because mathematics, although it is a product of the human mind, it's a set of rules that are founded in logic, and it's going to be the same everywhere. The statement 11 is a prime number is going to be just as true on Alpha Centauri as it is here on Earth. And given that the fundamental laws of physics, which the aliens need to know about if they're going to be doing engineering and communicating, given that they are mathematical relationships, we can assume that any alien civilization that we can communicate with is going to be familiar with things like the number pi or the number e, and the basic mathematical relationships of the universe. So that's a starting point. Mm-hmm. Of course, then it gets tough. We've got mathematics and basic physics, but beyond that, it's going to be a long, hard struggle. And it seems to me that concepts like patriotism or emergence or something of that sort, which would come from more sophisticated lines of thought, would take a very long time to communicate, and probably our sport or our politics or our religion would mean absolutely nothing to an alien species.
Our guest, Paul Davies, is a physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist at Arizona State University. He's the author of the book, The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence. And questions are welcome. We have a couple people here ready to go, and they've been patient, and I'll get right to them, going next to Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question is, who do people like you and other people in the scientific community report to? Because, you know, there was a book that's just recently released complaining about, you know, UFO sightings and why aren't they actually being reported, for instance, like the one that apparently they saw over O'Hare a few years ago, and, you know, the government says nothing. I mean, the government can't even tell us what they're doing with their taxes. You think they're going to tell us about this stuff? And if you guys are reporting it to your administrators and all that, that's probably all the farther it's going to go. It's not going to hit the mainstream media or even to each other.
No, I'm afraid you have a fundamental misconception there. So, first of all, we're not dealing with UFOs. There's other people who do that. This is talking about using radio telescopes to listen in to the sky in the hope of picking up alien radio traffic. That's the primary purpose. There are other things that are done as well. This is done completely openly. It's almost entirely privately funded. There's no element of secrecy. We don't have to report to anybody. It's a scientific enterprise. We can publish the results openly in scientific journals. But as a matter of fact, there is a sort of protocol about what we would do in the event that the signal was picked up. And I happen to chair something called the SETI Post-Detection Task Group. And this is has been set up by the International Academy of Astronautics. And it's meeting later this month in Prague. And I shall be chairing a meeting of this task group. We meet from time to time to discuss what will we do next. Suppose ET calls on my watch. You know, who do we tell and in what sequence? And there's a protocol which I give in my book. And I give the reference to the website, a protocol about who gets told and so on. There's no secrecy whatsoever in this enterprise.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. And I guess this just it does, for people who distrust government, this is one of those things that's always been a popular topic. That is, well, if the government did know that there was extraterrestrial life, or if ET had called, would they actually tell us?
Right. I mean, I don't trust governments either. The governments aren't interested in SETI. They pulled the funding on it here in the U.S. 15 years ago. And it's only been restored in a very limited way. We find it really hard to get politicians interested in this task group. I've tried. Occasionally I get inquiries from politicians about SETI, but this is entirely in a private capacity, just people who happen to be interested as individuals. There is no official government involvement in the entire SETI program. And as far as the UFO things are concerned, this is primarily a matter for the military. The U.S. government set up something called Project Blue Book back in the 50s, I think it was. And I knew the chief scientific advisor to that, Alan Hynek, who coined the term close encounters of the third kind, incidentally. I knew Alan very well, visited his home and looked through thousands of reports and was very much involved in that subject back in the 60s. It sort of went nowhere. Project Blue Book was wound up. As always, most of the cases got explained. A few didn't. We don't know what to make of that. The reports continue to come in. They don't seem any different from what they were in the 60s. I don't think that any of those UFO reports constitute evidence of extraterrestrial intelligent life. I think the idea that the flying saucers are spacecraft from other worlds simply doesn't stack up for all sorts of reasons, some of which I give in the book.
We'll go on to another caller here. This is also someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I'm enjoying the conversation. You've been talking about UFOs, but another question I had, looking over the web recently, I see quite a site there on crop pictures. Of course, that was discredited some years ago as a hoax, but then there seems to be a growing society, something like the SETI Society, that is investigating the many sightings that have occurred since then, principally in England. And they claim, that there's great proof that these are not human things. They think it's a communication. They don't know who's communicating, and they're trying to answer those questions. Does this have any credence at all in your mind?
No, I would completely dismiss all this crop circle stuff. It was a fad that started in the 60s, started in England, and it sort of spread around the world. Many of the hoaxers have told their stories about how they did it. I can't believe that this is still continuing, apart from a bit of fun or as an art form. Nobody in the scientific community takes this seriously. And so it sort of falls into the same category as fairy stories, ghost stories, and everything else. They're great fun to read about. But the SETI program that I'm talking about is a thoroughly scientific program carried out by some of the finest scientists and engineers in the world using state-of-the-art equipment and thoroughly proper scientific techniques, peer-reviewed publications, and so on. It's a world away from the sort of newspaper sensationalism of things like crop circles and UFO sightings. So we have to keep a clear demarcation about what is a sensible scientific approach in the search for ET and what is just a bit of fun, I think, in the case of the crop circles.
Clearly, this is something that fascinates and maybe worries some people, I don't know. Let me ask you this, as a serious scientist. If, in fact, it was established scientifically that there was life elsewhere, intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, do you think that people would, A, panic, would B, say, well, that's very, very fascinating, tell me more about that, or C, just say, oh, okay, fine, and just go on with their lives? What do you think that, and I know this is something that you've thought about, and I'm sure other people have thought about, what the general public reaction to this news would be?
Right. So it's part of the job of this SETI post-detection task group to answer those questions. And I think it very much depends on the nature of the evidence. Now, I think easily the most likely thing that would happen is that we pick up maybe a radio signal, but it may well be something else, some sign that we are not alone. And it could just be some distant planet that seems to have a feature about it that cannot be explained by any sort of natural means. Or it could be, as I said earlier, somewhat provocatively, something closer to home. Supposing we found buried nuclear waste on Earth, you know, from 100 million years ago. Could be something like that. But all we could say is, well, wow, we know that there must be at least one other intelligent civilization out there somewhere. And then I think it would be very much like when Copernicus found the Earth was going around the sun. When this was announced, it didn't cause any riots or any panic. It didn't change the price of beer. People went about their daily lives in very much the same way as before. But who could deny that over the centuries, the significance of this, it's enormously affected the way we see ourselves and our place in the universe. And although we don't go around every day thinking, oh, the Earth is going around the sun, we sort of know it subliminally. Deep down, we factor it into our worldview. The same thing with Darwin and the theory of evolution. At the time, there was a certain amount of unease about it and debate and discussion, but life went on, as it continues to go on. And yet, once again, the fact that we know that human nature is a product of nature, that we have evolved from other species on this planet, colors the way we think about ourselves and our place in the universe in a thousand different ways. And I think it would be very much like that. Nothing would change in the short term, but in the longer term, it would make a big difference. Hmm. Now, of course, if we're talking about picking up a message, so the canonical scenario as you get, for example, in the movie Contact, based on the book written by Carl Sagan, then I think all bets are off. If it's literally a message for mankind, crafted and beamed deliberately at us, along the lines of, hello, Earthlings, have I got news for you, you can imagine that this would be disruptive at all levels of society, and I think it would be very, very hard to predict the course of events or the impact that would have on society. Mm. But I think that's a very unlikely scenario.
A couple of minutes left, at least. We have some other callers. Charleston is next, line four. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about statistics earlier, using it to argue different points here. And I was curious, and this is a layman question, for sure. In physics, there's two theory sets, one to explain small things, the other to explain big things.
Right.
Is there something similar for statistics, where, you know, our normal statistic assumptions break down to really big events over big periods of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. When you're dealing with very rare events, then statistical fluctuations can become enormously important, much more so than... So if you toss a coin 3 times and you get 3 heads in a row, you wouldn't be unduly surprised. But if you did it 1,000 times and had 1,000 heads in a row, you would smell a rat. That is always a problem about dealing with statistical evidence of very rare events. But there's also another issue, if we're just referring back to the effect on civilization of a very unlikely event, that the when we're dealing with a very small probability of a very big event, people find it very hard to come to terms with that. And an easier case, which I actually refer to in my book, is supposing Earth is hit by an asteroid that kills 1 billion people. There's about a 1 in 1 million chance that will happen this year. A 1 in 1 million is a very small number, and we normally don't worry about such things, but the consequences and impact will be very big. So we have a very small probability of a very major disaster. How do we cope with that? How do we line that up alongside aircraft safety, for example, which comes out with a similar number in terms of the expectation of death? Somehow we give more attention to higher probabilities of smaller catastrophes. So I don't think there's a particular branch of statistics that factors in this sort of human element, but you're quite right that small numbers and big numbers come out very differently in the statistical game.
All right, I hope that at least it gives a partial answer. Let's go to Champagne for someone else here. Line 2, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on something the guest said earlier. He was talking about an example where a civilization, say, 1,000 light years away would not notice that we had an advanced civilization and therefore would not bother sending any kind of radio signals at us, and
right,
therefore we wouldn't pick them up. I was wondering, if the example of, say, our current civilization, we're sending out, I assume, our normal radio and TV signals are propagating
right
out into space, even if we don't intend to
That's
send
right
them to another planet, if things such as that would be detectable anyway.
Oh, yes. So those radio messages are going out, my words now, going out into space. We can't get them back. And in another 1,000 years, they will be 1,000 light years away. And if there is a civilization there, they've got a very big radio telescope because these are weak signals. They could pick it up. But no doubt, whatever, that our radio traffic could be picked up by a big enough dish even 1,000 light years away. So it's entirely possible that 1,000 light years away, even now, picking up our first feeble radio attempts, well, it wouldn't be now, but in another 900 years, picking up our first feeble attempts at radio. So in 900 years' time, they could know that we had radio technology, and they may then start beaming their messages, because it'll take another 1,000 years for that message to reach us. So we got a rather long wait if this is the scenario.
Mm. We're just about the point we have to finish. There is a big section here I'm sorry we hadn't really gotten to earlier that I think, though, was really quite fascinating, and people can look at the book if they're interested. And that has to do with the ability to perhaps come up with an answer to this question, are we alone, and we wouldn't even have to leave the Earth to do it.
Right.
And that has to do with this idea that it's possible life might have begun on Earth more than once.
Right, the shadow biosphere, the search for life 2.0 here on Earth. Absolutely right. I could just deal with that very briefly because I know we're running out of time. We were discussing earlier about how do we work out the odds of life out there in the universe, and I said, well, as we don't know how life began, we have no way of putting the numbers in. But we could do the experiment. That is, we could, if it's the case that life pops up readily in Earth-like conditions, surely it should have started many times over here on Earth. And then the next question is, how do we know it didn't? Has anybody actually looked? And to my astonishment, a few years ago, I realized that nobody had seriously looked for life on Earth as we don't know it. Now, I'm talking only about microbial life because we're pretty much familiar with everything else. But in the microbial realm, we've only just scratched the surface. We don't know what all those little bugs are. And some of them could be a radically alternative form of life. And I'm very happy to say that following a workshop held here at Arizona State University, there are now several research projects underway, some of them publicly funded, to look for a form of life on Earth here that will be so different from you and me, a known form of life, so different in its fundamental biochemistry that it must have started from scratch, independently of life that we know. So if we find life's happened twice on Earth, we could be pretty sure that it's popped up all around the universe. The chances of it happening twice on one Earth-like planet and not at all on all the other Earth-like planets are really very small.
Hmm. There certainly are people who argue that, and this obviously is a much bigger technical challenge if we were trying to resolve it, but make the argument that says there are places in our solar system right now where there might well be life, and that if we could just construct the right kind of probe and go there and look, it's possible that, one of the moons of Jupiter, for example, we might actually find it would most likely, again, be simple life, microbial life, but it would be life. A tough thing, a difficult technical challenge. It would be very expensive. Do you think that that's a study we're ever going to be able to do?
Well, it is, but let me repeat my earlier warning that because we know rocks fly back and forth in the solar system, we find life on Mars, for example, for my money, it's just going to turn out to be same old life as on Earth. In other words, we gain nothing by going to Mars. We might just as well look here on Earth for life 2.0. It's just as good as looking on Mars. Europa is further away and less likely to have been contaminated, but even so, the numbers suggest that it probably would have been. Getting at that life is a challenge. I think Mars is everybody's favorite, but it's if there is life on Mars, it's probably deep under the ground, and getting at it is not going to be easy. And so I've got an open mind about life on Mars. I think there probably is life still there. I'm sure there was once. I think there probably still is deep under the ground, just microbial life. Europa, I don't know. It's a much tougher one. But Europa has got a cap of ice, and if there's any life, it's deep beneath that. It's very hard to see how we get at it.
Mm. But you're saying it might well be the same stuff that we have here, essentially.
Yes, because of the cross-contamination.
Right.
I think that's the problem. So you have to go outside the solar system altogether if you want to be sure that life started from scratch, independently of life on Earth.
A very interesting subject. If people want to read more, look for the book The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt by our guest Paul Davies. He is a physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist at Arizona State University. And Professor Davies, thanks very much.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for inviting me on.